sorry for the drinking here. Thank you. No. All right, so my name is Sharon, and I'm an alcoholic. It's nice to be here. Last time I was here, I was asked to speak by Larry Dixon, so it's bittersweet to be here since he's passed away since that time. Tracy and Randy and William, congratulations. Thank you for sharing, Tracy, because you know, I usually start somewhere like this and then I have to kind of come down as I speak, so you started up there for me. I was born in Pennsylvania, Swarthmore, Pennsylvania. It's a pretty little town. I'm one of six kids in a Catholic home, and there were six kids, three dogs, two parents. Someone was always either peeing on the floor, barking, throwing up. In my mind, it was pandemonium. It wasn't a settled place, and it was run by alcoholism, undiagnosed alcoholism. So a lot of the worst features of alcoholic life and the alcoholic life upon children was going on in that household. You know, my father drank. He probably never had a chance, you know, from the start. His childhood was very hard, and he kind of couldn't get past a lot of that, and he brought it into my upbringing and my siblings. It was violent in the house, and it was violent. There were a lot of beatings, and there was sexual abuse. There was certainly emotional abuse. You know, I was raised with intimidation, and after a couple, you know, solid hits, you don't need to be hit anymore. All you need is a look, and then you're, you know, cowering. So, you know, my life as a little girl kind of blew up and had to be reassembled, if you will, after I got sober. Well, after I continued to blow it up, drinking and using for a long time, then we started the, you know, coming together. Not too sure what to say about my childhood. I was a little psycho. I was thinking today of this memory of a boy that I had been going out with, and hi, Hertford, and broke up with, and you know, his psychoness revealed itself after we broke up. So at times he'd be across the street in the bushes calling my name, and at one point he was in the backyard on the swing, and my father was trying to do this commando move where he grabbed the gun, was throwing open the back door, you know, getting onto the step, doing this with the rifle, and you know, within 6 seconds, that was all going, and at the same time, my mother was going, oh, and my brother was trying to hold back my father, and I was probably saying, Bob, run, you know. Another thing, recently I thought, gee, my dad used to always take out our stitches, and then I thought, why do we always have stitches? We had another unique feature that my father, just to prepare us, would have us jump off the roof into his arms, supposedly, so in case there was ever a fire, we'd be able to jump off the roof. Oh, Christ. I mean, really, as a kid, I have found raising children, we start, I think, with this sense of dignity, and then just gets obliterated in an alcoholic home. You know, like, Dad, I really don't want to jump off the roof, you know? Like, nobody in the block is jumping off the roof. I know that for sure. And, you know, Dad's driven up on the neighbor's lawn and all that stuff. It was a scary place for a little girl to be. And the first moment I could, I ran away and, you know, found myself I went out to Colorado. I was in Pennsylvania. Went out to Colorado where my sister and brother-in-law lived and realized I had absolutely no idea whatsoever as to how to live a life. You know, okay, I'm free. Oh. How do you get a job? What's insurance? You know, where do you get gas? You know, how do I get a car? And it was like, woo. So I had to go back home. And the second time I ran away, I was a touch more equipped. But I moved to Martha's Vineyard in the winter. Because, you know, any silly person could move in there in the summer. So I figured winter's, like, cool. Being on an island in the Atlantic Ocean in the winter is pretty cold. I worked at a restaurant, and for some reason, the guy that owned the restaurant, at the end of the night, I think that he either thought I drank, you know, interestingly or funny or cute or something, because he would take a bottle off the bar and give it to me to go home. And I went home and drank it like it was a homework assignment. And it was stuff that was wretched. I hated it. It was like B&B and Crevassier and crack. You know, crack. Not crack. Tia Maria, you know. I didn't like one drop of it, but I drank it all. That ought to tell you something at 18 years of age that, you know, there might be some story coming along to reach your brain one of these years. I always knew that I needed to go somewhere to find something, and I didn't know where I was going, and I didn't know what I was looking for, and I didn't know what I was going to find. But my idea was to just keep going. So I left Martha's Vineyard at one point and drove out to Colorado and then stayed in Colorado for a while. And from Colorado, did this hitchhiking trip to California, but of course, true insanity. I was with my boyfriend. We're like, yeah, we're gonna walk. We're gonna like walk. We're gonna take only a few rides, you know. And anybody can hitchhike, you know. Like we're gonna walk to California. I was, you know, driven by a lot of self-delusion for sure, of all types, and hitchhiked all through there. Went out to California, went back to Martha's Vineyard, moved out to California. The thing was, each step of the way, there was something to do with my alcoholism. When I was on the vineyard, on the island, I was in this blizzard, you know, like that was knocking me over, and I was going from one little town to another just to get a bottle, and this will age me, of Matus. But I had that, like, the 30 or 20 questions was in my head from some other experience, and not that I paid any attention to, obviously, but the thought came, like, really loud as I was traversing this blizzard. Do you drink alone? Why, golly, as a matter of fact, I do. But that was the extent of the thought, you know, the boom. In 1997, for some reason, the American or the United States Post Office put out a stamp that said alcoholism. Now, I bought one of those stamps. One stamp. I wasn't in the habit of writing letters to anybody. And I put it in my writing book, and then I turned the page. Okay, there's, you know, if it's a clue, I'm not going to catch up with it for many years. I just don't think a lot of people were doing that. Can I have one stamp? Yeah, thanks. Okay, so then I left California and I went back to the East Coast and I moved into a meditation center for 2 years. I had already by that time had a sense of, you know, I know dropping acid isn't, like, really working to make me fit in the world. And all the other drugs that I keep putting in my hands and up my nose and all that kind of stuff. And I'm of a, generation that there are drugs all over. So in my case, I'd say they helped to accelerate the bottom, that if I were only drinking, that, is that Lorna? Oh, my goodness, hi. Lorna, what? Which was it? Celebrated, haha. What? Drugs. Yeah. I'm getting to the bottom. Yeah, it's coming. Drugs, alcohol, blah, blah, blah. You know, each state had its own drug that, you know, that went along with it. And, you know, when I started dropping acid, after I actually got a real job, I'd take the acid at 2 o'clock in the afternoon because I got off from my job at 3. And a lot of times I'd come off, you know, get off a little too soon. So I looked really strange at about 2:45 on a lot of days. Or they looked a lot of they're pretty strange, I don't know. But I went to this meditation center because I wanted to live in a different way. And I was driven by that. But as I said, the directions I was going in weren't getting me there. So 2 solid years I lived in this place. You know, didn't drink, didn't smoke cigarettes, didn't do any kind of drug. You know, we ate stuff that would not be too exciting for our nervous system. it was quite a different experience than dropping acid, doing coke, and drinking till I vomited. So when I came out of that place, I happened to go to a party in Connecticut. I had been in upstate New York. Somebody invited me to a party. I didn't know the people. So I went from this utterly pristine environment, 2 years straight, to these people I didn't know. And at one point, this fellow who lived in the house said something amazing to me, like, "You seem special." Well, you got me all figured out, buddy. that's about all it took. And so I snorted coke for the, you know, next 3 days, and we were engaged pretty soon. And just one of a few guys I had no business being engaged to, I assure you. And in fact, that was an amends that I had to make quite a bit into my sobriety, because I didn't even know what the amends was until I finally could feel it. You know, I was still, like, having fun when he asked me to marry him and gave me a ring, and his family came from out of town, and there was a lovely party, and these were people that had drank sherry before dinner in little glasses, and it was just, we were so civilized and so cool, and, you know, this was a dream come true. I'm going to drink like a normal person right before I throw up on you, you know, just... It was definitely not going to work the way that it, you know, that I wanted to in my brain. And I had an opportunity from, instead of staying in Connecticut with Mark, my sister and brother-in-law had just gone to the Peace Corps to West Africa. So I went to West Africa. And in terms of my drinking, you know, what West Africa was about was that they had those gigantic bottles of beer. No, thank you. I don't like beer. And they were warm, if not hot. And really soon, I was just really fond of hot, big bottles of beer because that was all there was. So, you know, when people talk about, you know, I could take this medication. It wasn't my drug of choice. Who cares? You know, a drug of choice is under my nose or in my mouth or in your pocket. And I'm going to steal it. Speaking of stealing, I used to steal toilet paper from where I worked because I didn't want to waste my own money on such a stupid thing. I needed drugs and alcohol to buy. Thank you very much. So anyway, all I can tell you is it accelerated and accelerated and accelerated, and I got very sick in West Africa. I had contracted hepatitis A. They're very unsanitary conditions. I was in a place where there was not electricity, not running water. So a wonderful experience, but I did happen to get very sick. And when I came from there, my mother had just moved from Pennsylvania to La Jolla, California. So I went to where she was to recuperate. And I don't know about you guys. But, like, I hear different than a lot of other people. I had a doctor at the hospital that said, you can't drink. Okay, that seems pretty much English language to a lot of people. I heard, now if you can, as much as you can, don't drink whenever you can, okay? You know, it was just this all soft around the edges. Lots of ways out from the, you know, declarative sentence that he had given me. So I'm sick, blah, blah, blah. I have to tell you a funny job I had when I had run away another time. I was up in upstate Pennsylvania, and I went to work for at a donut shop because I had a really good resume at that point. And I was supposed to open this place, which I was chronically late for, and make the coffee, which I was really bad at. And they also had these tubs with, like, spigot, and you were supposed to, like, impale these donuts and tap it a couple of times, and it would fill up with the cream or the jelly. I'd put those suckers on it, tap, 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 you know. Like, every fifth donut was like, oh, Jesus, you know. Believe me, I cannot stand the smell of a donut shop. But the job that I got after I came back from West Africa, I didn't going to tell you how it worked, but I got a job as an answering service operator. And it was like the old-fashioned, you know, put the plug in and, you know, got your, huh, and hi, and it was perfect, especially if you're on speed, of course. It was... I love everyone. I love all your clients. I love all your patients. I love your family. I love, you know... We talked about everything. Yowzer. So, finally, you know, it's you know, like, funny, and it's nuts. The word insanity, for most of us in our stories, you know, loses its potency real fast. It's, you know, whatever is insanity to the thousandth degree, that's what, you know, most of us get to, and I did. So I'm in La Jolla. I'm trying to get free from the Hep A, giving blood every week. I'm not improving. And finally, I'm at a point, once again, where I feel like I can't do this. Life seems like a mystery. I see people that have driven a car that even looks washed, and they went to a job. And they've probably done this like 5 days straight. And they stayed there from when they were supposed to when they got out. And when they left for lunch or went for a dentist appointment, they didn't stay out for 6 hours like I did. It was just this mystery. And, you know, as a girl, it was like, I'd look at women with, like, matching purses and shoes. It was like, wow, how'd you do that, you know? and you reminded me of something, Tracy, because the girl that I worked with for a while, we were doing this, real women do this. You know, real women have checkbooks, you know, so I went and bought a checkbook. And I signed all the checks ahead of time so they'd be ready. Just to have to go back and fill them in. And real women buy dishes. So, you know, some sort of like four set from, you know, Costco or God knows where. And by God, I had dishes in my house. And the real good one was real women wear slips underneath their dresses. what more could you ask, you know? So I was making these incremental steps to what I imagined might be, you know, something like adulthood. And one of the lines I love from Adult Children of Alcoholics program is, adult children of alcoholics guess at what is normal. They guess at what is normal. Oh, my. Here, you want to sum up my life in a sentence or what my brain tracks? You know, I worked in business for 16 years. Vice president, managed tens of millions of dollars, and every once in a while I'd go, what would a real broker do? You know, what would a real mom do? Yeah, you've been a mom for about 18 years now, so, you know, it's not a big surprise, but I think it's maybe because my household was very tense, very, very, very tense. What I realized today when I was driving at some point, that for as much iron-fisted, closed-fisted discipline in that house, there wasn't order at all. So I don't want to tell you how old I was when I realized I had this like gum on my teeth, and it was because I wasn't brushing my teeth regularly. Nobody ever happened to say, you should brush your teeth, you know, morning and night. That's kind of a common experience for children. I think I was the breaking point by the time I got there. I was the fourth kid. I think I was my father's breaking point. I think by that time for my mother, it was like almost like a pet, like just put the food out, let them eat it, and, you know, whatever. I have years that I can't recall what was going on in my life, years. And there's nobody really to ask right now. But, you know, every once in a while I think, how did I get to school? I don't know how I got to school. I don't know. I went to Catholic school. I knew where I lived and where the school was. But I couldn't picture if I went with a neighborhood family. I didn't know if we drove and there were a couple of us kids that went. You know, that's not real normal, but I'm probably not the only person in the room that can say this. It's weird. Because as a little kid, there's a lot of stuff that I just started, you know, having to put aside and check out and leave alone and come back and rescue those parts of my sobriety. I lost myself completely. I was getting sober. Wow, strange mental blank spots are us. I guess I'll get to the next part. I was finally, one more time, done, couldn't bear anymore it being 4 o'clock in the morning. I have to go to work at 6. The shower that I have searing hot and beating on my head can't be louder than the thoughts that are violating my brain. I had this constant critic in my head that I was trying to kill through drinking. You know, there was always somebody keeping score. Always somebody to give their opinion, like what an ass I was, what a jerk I was, what a worthless, irresponsible, no good shit I was. I mean, I came with that to AA with that stamped in my DNA. That's what I was. You know, it's really something in Alcoholics Anonymous because we find each other, and you know, there used to be a commercial of this little black girl that would say, I learned to be a fairy queen at the Y. And sometimes I think, I learned to be a fairy queen in AA. You know, these selves reveal themselves, you know. Even if we've been, like, beaten or stepped on or left behind or whatever, the grace that has come into my life only after I got to Alcoholics Anonymous and then have been working the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, there's a lot that I couldn't have even imagined that would happen. I went to a meeting on give you an idea where I was at. I called Alcoholics Anonymous one night and I asked them, I said, I'm in La Jolla and I need to go to a meeting. And they said, there's a meeting in Scripps at Scripps Hospital and, you know, 7 o'clock tomorrow night or something. I said, okay, bye. I didn't know where Scripps Hospital was. I was like living in this world like this. And of course, I wouldn't ask directions from somebody. So I drank for another year. And so a year later, I'm completely at that point of desperation again. Don't know how to go forward. Don't know how to go back. Don't know how to get to work every day. Everything's a mystery. I had to take a federal exam for my work in El Cajon. I mean, honest to God, I was like, where in hell is El Cajon? You know, as though it weren't on the map somewhere. A lot of stuff was throwing me, I guarantee you. But so I called Alcoholics Anonymous again. And they said, there is a meeting tomorrow night in La Jolla on Girard Avenue. And I lived on Girard Avenue. Thank you very much. So I walked to that meeting. Now, one of my sisters was a nurse, and she was living in this area for a while. And I kept, like, begging her to let me go, like, as her patient, you know, like that she could bring me. Because I didn't know what it was going to be like to go to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. I didn't want to. And I, you know, I was afraid there would be a couple little people that would say, hi, you know. I'd feel like I was, you know, sprouting horns or, you know, whatever, spontaneously busting in flame. So the idea of, like, kind little people coming up and saying stuff to me made me insane. So my sister was, like, shaking me off like a puppy, you know, like, oh, for God's sake, you know. So she did not agree to take me. So I went to this meeting on Girard Avenue. It was Mary Star of the Sea. And you know, I think sometimes of if you're doing a mathematical or scientific chart and, you know, we look at our drinking and our drinking's going like this or just straight up and our using is getting worse and our lives are falling apart and everything's getting worse and our relationships are, you know, to hell and our finances are, I was into petty cash at work, you know, to about $120. It was like $15 worth of petty cash, but I needed some. And so how does this thing go? You're charting this experience, and it's just getting worse and worse and worse, and you're going off the chart. And then I went to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous one day, and I never drank again. You know, it's only people in this room that kind of get a chill and understand that. Now, I went home and smoked pot for a while just to... I had some deliberating to do. I was considering how special it was now that I was going to be clean and sober and had no idea what they meant by clean, so smoked pot till October. My sobriety date is October 31st, 1983. And hoorah! And so it's been fun. Sometimes I've dressed like a nun on Halloween and taken my cake. I could honestly say I didn't look like this when I got here. And another time I was like this Victorian something or other with a parasol. And, you know, just hell, might as well have some fun. I'm sober another year. To give you an idea where I was on that April 8th, 1983, you know, I went to this meeting. People were looking at each other. They were happy. They were talking. They were smiling. They were... something was going on in that room that I hadn't been around in a long time. And at the end of the meeting, I didn't know that the guy, the secretary, was joking. And he said, if you would like to make this your home group, we have one membership left. So someone that was not getting in my way for that membership. Fine, bitch. I was willing to take anybody out. Anyway, so, and I've had that membership ever since. Never gave it back. So, you know, then started this life that, as I told you before, I couldn't decipher one bit. And this guy told me, you know, here's this woman, call this woman, you know, she looks sober, right? And I'm, you know, like, vibrating in the room. And I think, as Tracy said, I would have done anything. I would have absolutely done anything. And it took me 3 years into my sobriety to realize that everybody that came along didn't get sober, because the way I felt was like, oh, my God. You know, it's like the curtains parted, and there was one moment of sunshine, and God put me in there, and I got sober. It just seemed like, if you had the opportunity, wouldn't everybody just, you know, get sober? And obviously that's not everybody's experience, but it was mine. I just felt, well, one thing is that word alcoholism, it just covered so much bad behavior in one word. It was great. You know, you're not nuts, you're not insane, you're not entirely a thief, you're not so much of a liar. It's like, oh, okay. So alcoholism was a name, and the word honesty hung in the room like it was big 10-foot letters. It was like, because by that time, everything was dishonest, and I was always trying to pull myself together. And you know, do I look all right? Do I smell like, you know? Do you know that I have my clothes on from yesterday? Did I, you know? Sorry. See, the idea of actually living honestly with myself as much as anybody else was really a big thought. So I started following women and following directions, and that was a big change. As with many of us, I was all on my own, you know, self-propelled insanity prior to this. And if somebody had told me they wanted to, I just would have followed their direction. That's what I'm telling you. And I can tell you that everything that I did in that first year, even in that first couple of months, are things that I do today. I have a sponsor. I talk with my sponsor. I love my sponsor. Because I've taken the steps, I get to be a sponsor. One of my beloved sponsees is here tonight. You know what? There aren't many people in your entire life that you'll call beloved, that you're my beloved sponsee. This relationship is astonishing, you know, like what we get to give to each other after it's been given to us. So I got sober, and, you know, like life started revealing itself, and I learned how to, like, say things. I am not joking when I say that I could not decipher when I got here what it was like to be, if I were hungry or if I were angry. Everything was a jumbled, you know, tangle. I was walking down the street in PB one day, and there was a bank of televisions on inside a store, and Arnold Schwarzenegger was on there blowing the crap out of something, and I thought, oh, I'm angry. Yeah. You know, like that. You know, that's how I feel. That's right. So it took a long time to decipher that kind of, you know, untangling. You know, I've been sober for 27 years, which was as likely when I got here as me flying to the moon. I had no equipment. I had no equipment to manage sadness in my life, and nor did I have the equipment to manage joy of any type. In terms of managing things, sometimes I think of my alcoholism as like it's a governor in the car, or that part of yourself that when you've finished eating your fill, you know, step back and say, oh, I've had enough. I'm not equipped with that in terms of alcohol and drugs. I don't have something that says, I've had enough. It says, maybe if you throw up, you could drink more, you know. Just. So this life started to develop, and I started having success in my work. And I met a man in Alcoholics Anonymous, and we got married and were very world famous in our own minds for many years. And right before I got sober, I went to this bar, and I walked in, you know, I had my beret on, and I knew that the tempo picked up when I walked in, you know, the bar. So, you know, talk about being delusional. But at the end of the night, I invited the entire barload and the band back to my one-bedroom apartment. And they came. And now, I didn't mention that my husband was at home. I happened to be married at the time, and didn't consider that he might have an opinion about that. I had gotten I'd gotten married in April, and I got sober in August. It was like, oh, man, I'm sorry. So one day at a time for the first year, I learned to not leave a marriage because I was supposed to follow directions, and I learned to do that. But this, you know, at this barload of people in my one-bedroom apartment, it's like you can smell the drug dealer, you know. Oh, you. let's be friends. And I went off with three people that I didn't know, and I was gone for three and a half days, and I never once thought, my husband might be wondering where I am. You know, it's really uncool to forget that you're married. I just did. I never thought of it and dismissed it. I was just too busy snorting coke and drinking and whatever else important thing I had to do. And so to finally get sober and to start living like a real person and, you know, not feel like I had green horns coming out of the top of my head and was wildly different than everybody else because I had some ping-pong popcorning thoughts going on for you know, quite a long time. But therapy served me really well. Having a reflection from other people, and in my case it was sober people, that said to me, you know, I know what you mean, or, yeah, I feel that way too. I had not been accustomed in my house to hear that kind of stuff, so you just start thinking you're, you know, there's a great little pin I used to have that said, separated from my group. It's like, there's a group for me somewhere, I know it. I didn't know it was going to be here. So my husband and I had our first son in 1989, and he is my beloved Max, and he's in the front row right now. And he had 30 days yesterday? Yeah. Yeah. You should know he really should be sober. This was a boy that at the age of 4 told me he wanted to be black when he grew up. All right. All right, keep coming back, honey. I was 7 years sober when I was pregnant with my second boy, and 4 days before my baby boy was due to be born, he died inside me. He was stillborn, and I did, you know, like the once again, like life seemed to be just blown to bits. I didn't understand it. I was in the hospital. It was emergency C-section. I was in the hospital for 5 days. When I came out, it was Max's 2-year birthday, and only AA people understand that when I came home, there was a banner that said, "Welcome home, Sharon," and "Happy birthday, Max," and people had come into the house and wrapped presents for Max and, you know, had a cake and everything else. You know, people around here, like, scoop you up if you can't, you know, move. And that's what happened for us. And, you know, life went on. It was kind of funny there for a while because my husband and I were having two really different experiences. I was thinking, I'm not going to breathe again until I get pregnant again. And he was thinking, let's never do that again. I'd be like, just get up. I'll do everything. Just, you know. You don't even have to be awake. At one point, I said to him, unfortunately, I said to him, "Well, I'm getting pregnant from somebody." He's like, "Ooh, sorry, sorry, honey." Anyway, after a year, I had a miscarriage, and I just thought that the world was, you know, upside down, insane. I didn't understand. The best thing that I heard that a friend of mine gave me at that time was, "We have to leave room for the mystery of God." Oh, that like kind of saved me. People don't know what to say to you when there's a tragedy, and then another tragedy. And besides saying I'm sorry, which I've learned, we have to leave room for the mystery of God. There was no understanding, like there wasn't anything that happened from me or Jack that the baby died. You know, I'll never understand why, but that's what happened. And, you know, it's in the realm of the mystery of God. So I started a step study. And during that step study, I started looking at the fourth step in a different way. They talked about instincts, you know, instincts on rampage, balk at investigation. Well, I had an instinct to be pregnant and have another baby. And I had to put that huge desire into this different category, you know, and start being able, after a year, I mean, of every single solitary day trying to let go. You know, I think, okay, I let go. Now I'm pregnant, right? You know, I was really amped up about this, but I started this step study. I had this catharsis with the fourth step information, instincts. Okay. So I moved away from that, and I was pregnant by the end of that step study. And, you know, it's new. And my son, Sam, is Max's brother. He's Sam, Max's 21, Sam's 16. 17, he just turned 17. I must, this can't be happening. But you know what's cool? I know I have to end. There's so many women I know in Alcoholics Anonymous that saw me when I was pregnant with these children. They watched these children grow up, and these children were raised in safety. You know, they weren't, pardon me, they weren't in people's homes where a cigarette was accidentally being dropped on them because everybody was, you know, blown out of their mind on some drug. They've never had that kind of experience. They weren't beaten. They weren't harmed, except whatever way we harmed you, which is... We used to joke right from the start, let's just start with a therapy fund, you know. Of course they're going to need therapy. But, you know, we had the best equipment. The best human being that I can be on any given day is being sober. Then I got all the chances in the world. I start my day and my later in the day with prayer and meditation. And it for me is the thing that if I do that, I feel like I have done the very best, and not taking a drink, very best stuff within my realm of doing that I can possibly do. And the rest is up to God and the universe and everything that's coming along. I've learned to work the steps. I love the steps. I wish I could tell you more things about the steps, but I have to stop talking. You know, one of the things is like the third step of turning our will and our life over to the care of God. You know, caring like a baby. I used to always think it was like, unconsciously, I was thinking it's kind of like you're turning it over to the whim of God. And the seventh step, it took me a long time to recognize that they were saying, humbly asked God to remove our shortcomings. I was casually thinking that God should remove my shortcomings because I had done the first six steps, you know, like... Come on, chick, chick, chick. So that was worth going back for. And there's more, I can't race into it. If you're new here, I know that there was a woman that was introduced as new. This is the best deal you'll ever run into. Alcoholics Anonymous is the utter foundation of my life. I have learned to become a woman here. I like that. I've learned to love women here. I've learned to love men safely. You know, like, let's just say that. Your husbands are safe from me, you know. Let's just say that wasn't always so. I think I should stop now. Thank you.